welcome to Radio Gorgeous, and welcome to Man Week. Hooray! Yay. It only comes but once a year, and it's no accident that it also is aired on the week of Thanksgiving. So we are very grateful today to have Paul Joynson Hicks and Tom Sullum of the Comedy Wildlife Photography Awards. There's a book associated with it, with the most adorable pictures of animals ever. There is literally on the front cover a sea otter doing a doe face. So it would make a delightful Christmas gift. Anyway, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Tell me, Paul, I think you started the awards. Tell me about the awards themselves.
So in 2015, I was sitting in my at home in Arusha in Tanzania, and I was looking at another massacred elephant online, and I was thinking, I'm not inspired by this to do anything. It's sad. It makes me feel sad, and it didn't invigorate me to action about conservation. Obviously, for many, many years, I've seen these kind of pictures like we all have. And so I thought, well, there's got to be another way of attracting attention to conservation issues and with wildlife. And I'm a wildlife photographer. And it was about the time I'd had an exhibition and sold very quickly my two funny pictures in the exhibition. So I thought, well, why don't we have a competition? And let's get all the funny pictures from around the world and put them into one place. And then we can attract some attention, and then we can talk about conservation, but with a positive and funny message.
Because inviting people to take funny pictures of animals invites people to engage with animals and to engage with animals in the animal's environment. So necessarily, you're bringing awareness
totally
to the issue.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the fantastic thing about this idea is that people are given a sort of certain energy when they see an animal, and they laugh with whatever the animal is doing, or they laugh, they associate someone they know, themselves, humans, with that animal's behavior. And that response in itself makes you just embrace that little bit more, the wildlife. And as Paul's just said, if you can then bring in the conservation issues, which is what sort of underlies the whole competition, then you've already got that positive link with it. And people mm-hmm. have already bought in. They've made that first step.
Is that what attracted you to the project?
Actually, Paul's idea is so good. And the press interest was so off the charts. And I was living in Tanzania at the time. And Paul used to come down and stay with us in Dar es Salaam. And he said, I don't suppose you want to help me a little bit, because this thing has gone onto another level. And I was more than happy to be involved.
Drafted in.
Excellent. So, Tom, how did you come to photography? Because I understand you started out with a financial background.
Yeah, my standard kind of, British university, don't really know anything. You must presumably have to get a job in the city. So I did that. And then after 10 years, I thought, there must be other things that I could be doing in my life. Mm. And my uncle's a landscape photographer, and he talked to me and said, you've always had a good eye, why don't you try this? And I think he was just being polite, but I took him seriously, and I stopped what I did in the city and became a photographer and focused more on commercial photography until my wife got this job in Tanzania, and we moved as a family, and the rest, as they say, is...
Well, you showed your uncle, because not only did you become a photographer, but you became an award-winning photographer.
I got, thanks to Paul's competition, you realise quite how subjective it is to win a competition. Mm. And you've got, the right day, right time, right judges, right type of weather, everything has to come together. And so there's a high element of chance. But yes, I won a Fuji competition, which was great. And it gives you a bit of confidence in yourself, mm-hmm. which is, a lot of photographers have slightly fragile egos, and if your pictures aren't liked, you question everything. And if they are liked, you suddenly think, well, everything's fine.
So tell me how difficult it is to judge this competition, because you must be inundated, spoiled for choice in terms of...
It's very difficult because, I think you can eke out the sort of the images that don't tick all the photography boxes quite quickly, but then you're left with a core, you know, of several hundred pictures that are really great and really funny. Mm. And that's when the hard work starts.
Yeah, because also you don't, and I presume that that's the idea behind the book, because also if a large part of the project is, you know, conservation at its base, mm. you do want to encourage people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also share as with as many people. Mm. So I understand that would make total sense. It's
Because we only have 40 finalists that get a lot of media coverage. So like you say, it's nice to be able to put 120 pictures in a mm-hmm. book, as well as our, you know, our conservation message and the support that Born Free get when we mm. sell the book. So it's
yes,
really
tell
good.
Me about Born Free, because Born Free supports this competition and the awards. Tell me about Born Free Foundation.
So when we started the competition, it was very obvious that, you know, we needed a conservation partner, and, you know, the money side of it was going to be limited, certainly at the beginning. But we wanted a relationship with an organization that was doing stuff, doing really good conservation work, and wasn't a vast sort of monolith of conservation, like some of the giant organizations that spend so much money on administration and that sort of thing, whereas Born Free is very much project-based. And my wife set up a marine conservation organization called Sea Sense, and Born Free funded her from the very beginning. So we had a relationship with them. So we got in touch with them, and they said, yeah, they're on board. Count us in.
Fantastic. And in your time in Dar es Salaam, were you able to travel around Tanzania? Because as we were talking before, I've been to Tanzania and some of the game reserves there. Was that an opportunity for you for your photography?
Yeah, totally. I mean, we're a modern family. My wife had the job, so she had to work, and the kids were at school, so I had quite a lot of freedom to travel. Once I'd met Paul, who lived up north in Arusha, there was suddenly a reason also to do more. And I'm not a wildlife photographer, so talking to Paul and working with Paul, you kind of get into it and you start to learn a new trade, a new skill. Not one that you master, but you pick it up. And there was no pressure on me to have to deliver any amazing wildlife shots. And
none.
Tanzania, but I did.
No, not really.
Debatable.
Review this afterwards. But it was just an amazing opportunity to see a country which was so far removed from, you know, I'd lived 30 years in Southwest London, to then move to East Africa was just a phenomenal opportunity on every level. I didn't have to travel far to have stuff to photograph or stuff to see. Mm. It was a fantastic time. And the fact that Comedy Wildlife has grown out of that is sort of a permanent memory of it all.
Yeah, mm. Wonderful. And can you tell me, in terms of conservation in Tanzania, what changes have you seen? I mean, over the years, because when I went there, you know, a long time ago, 10, 15 years ago, I mean, to me, it was very interesting, the relationship with the wildlife, because for most people living there, and my sister-in-law, you know, it was sort of like pests, because, you know, if you're trying to farm, you know, very dangerous large animals mm-hmm. around and things like that. So there was a very different relationship that she felt than, you know, so going out into the bush, and she had no interest in doing it. Whereas we came, you know, from America and from London, and we're like, oh my God, this is, you know, yeah. That's what we wanted to do. So, but it was a very different relationship, and that, you know, also seems somewhat uncomfortable culturally. But aside from that, seeing the environment and the animals in a different way doesn't seem like it would aid conservation.
So, you know, the last probably 30 years, you know, obviously not being good from a conservation point of view. Poaching has increased, especially in the less busy national parks and game reserves. Right. Terrible. And what you're talking about is the human-wildlife conflict zones. And so around all these game reserves, and some of it's tourism, some of it's hunting, around these game reserves, you know, you have your farmers that are getting their crops smashed by elephants and buffaloes and all sorts of things. And it's, I mean, it's terrible because they're the poorest people on the planet, amongst the poorest people on the planet. And, you know, what, you know, why should we ask them not to kill this elephant because it's destroyed their crops? Now, that family may well not be able to send their kid to school because they've got no money. Their wife could get sick and they'd have no money because they got no crop anymore. So they're going to kill that elephant so it doesn't come back and do it again. So it's very hard for us, for conservationists, to say, don't do that. So lots and lots and lots of work has been done on trying to create all sorts of mechanisms to stop human-wildlife conflict, because it's understood that these are the poorest people in the world, and so you can't tell them not to kill things. So what, you know, there's all sorts of ideas like planting chili bushes, like having beehives, but it's, some of it's more effective than others, and it's a ongoing issue, and it's tough. It's really tough. I mean, there's some areas where it happens a lot, and the conservation organizations just pay the farmers for their crops that get destroyed. But of course, then you're getting into a whole nother world where, you know, where money's involved. You know, oh, this lion killed my cow, and you bring a dead cow, you know, but it's slightly suspicious because the claw marks are sort of, one's that far apart, and one's that far apart, one's that far apart. Interesting claw marks. So, but some of it is genuine. And, you know, a Maasai has his cow killed, you know, that's his livelihood. So it's tricky. It's really, really tricky. And it's, like we were talking about, it's a very negative problem, which is where we come in trying to get people talking about it, but positively. And I think also, I think one of the other problems with conservation is that people see it on the telly, and they're seeing two things on the telly. One is they're seeing on the news, elephants slaughtered, one every 25 minutes, rhinos decimated in southern Africa, you know, and then one rhino flown from South Africa to Kenya at a cost of $1 million. And people are thinking, oh no, that's terrible. And then, oh, all that money could be spent on something else. And then the next thing they're seeing is Blue Planet by, you know, Our Planet or whatever it is by David Attenborough. And it's amazing wildlife films and documentaries. And everyone thinks, oh, well, this is fine. You know, all our wildlife is blooming. But actually it's not. And it's a false messaging. Mm. And there's so much of it. Our Planet, Blue Planet, Your Planet, His Planet, Her Planet. I mean, it's false messaging. And it's amazing filming. Don't get me wrong. And I love watching it. But all that you think at the end of it is just, holy moly, that's not really how it is. Mm. Those wild dogs that you're seeing, you know, from the air, and they're hunting, and it's amazing, but they're being decimated because of drought, because of climate change. You know, these lions are getting decimated, getting poisoned by Maasai cattle herders because they're eating their cows. I mean, that's the reality, not these really, really beautiful wildlife things. But again, you can see how the message is so negative. And I'm a naively positive human being, so I'm always wanting to try and think positively. So ergo the comedy wildlife. And it's taking it away from the big five of Africa and the slaughter that's going on there, and actually moving it into today's conservation message. It's, what can I do at home here, you know, in London, in Birmingham, in New York, in Scunthorpe, wherever I am. But there's so much you can do. There's so much you can do.
I would say, I am always amazed how much wildlife there is here in London. Mm. I mean, I came home from yoga one night and there was a hedgehog. And I was like, oh yeah. My God.
In your sitting room.
What are you doing? But I have to say, there is a lot less in New York. Hence why I was hugely shocked when there was a bullfrog in the courtyard of our, you know, for brownstone. Yes, exactly. I was absolutely shocked. Because yes, you see cats, dogs, rats, birds. You know, exactly, but that's about it.
Yeah, hence why the green spaces of London are phenomenal, which is why you have so much wildlife. And it's fantastic. I mean, London is a great place to actually, as Paul's just suggested, starting the environmental process at home and starting to care at home forgetting about the shame that you feel when you see the kind of brutal images of the slaughtered rhinos, which often just make you turn away and turn off.
Yeah.
And as Paul said, then you see the positive movies and you think, well, hey, everything's great. I don't need to do anything, which is the exact opposite of what should be happening. And starting at home, there are so many things you could do, so many sort of simple tips. And, you know, you can go online. We have a number of tips that we've thought about. We don't have to go through them because it comes down to thinking about how am I going to use the water. You know, don't flush too often. Don't leave the tap running when you're brushing your teeth. Don't shower for too long. Tiny little things. And, you know, together, Paul and I's plan has been to just try and engage people so that the tiny steps that we all take together end up being bigger and bigger steps. And it's very cliched because it ends up, you know, in the giant step, but you can only get the ball rolling at the start and it will be slow, but people can do a lot. And, you know, we have many different ways of doing something at home.
I would say, well, in the 70s in the States, when there was water shortage, the message was, yellow's mellow, brown goes down.
Yeah, absolutely. But you think about it.
We do that in our house.
There's 20 million households in the UK, roughly, depending on who you eat. Now, if each household saved, you know, 100 litres a day, you know, you flush once, that's 20 litres, unless you've got a special new swanky loo. But it's, you know, 20 litres for one flush. You know, you've got a household of four people, you know. You turn the tap off while you're brushing your teeth, you have shorter showers, less baths. You know, suddenly you're talking about billions of litres. You're talking about cubic metres of water, you know, millions and millions and millions, lakes of water that we're saving, which is going to go stay in the environment, you know, looking after our trees and our wildlife, you know, and it's, you know, it's really important.
Excellent.
Yeah, you know, everything has another stage also. And, you know, the water management, the more you use water, the more energy you need to pump the water. That energy doesn't need to be spent. That's another, you know, it reduces pollution at that side. So everything does have an effect. So the people that go, it's just a plastic straw. You go, yeah, it is just a plastic straw, as 8 billion other people just said when they got their plastic straws. But everything does make a difference. And just like, I don't want to mention politics, but just like the political situation, your vote does count. Your little things that you do at home do count, however small. Because it's, and we know how difficult it is to try and... We're part of a generation that will find it extremely difficult to try and change our lives so much that we do that we leave no footprint whatsoever. It's virtually impossible. Unless you go naked in a cave, you're going to be leaving some kind of footprint. But therefore, do a little bit just to sort of slow down the process. And what you'll find by doing a little bit, importantly, is that you'll probably start having discussions at home, start engaging the kids, and that generation is remarkably kind of aware, it seems, at the moment of what's going on. But engage even younger kids. You know, they can, their kids understand a lot more than they make out. Or mine do. They definitely hide what they understand.
But they're also, kids are also very easily influenced by their peers. Mm. So, you know, you've got a kid who becomes vegetarian because of the climate change crisis. He's talking to his friends about it. You know, then there's a sudden, a really, really, really passionate conversation going on around the school playground. And, you know, maybe it's about recycling, maybe it's about how or where you travel to, or we're not going to go to Africa this year because of the, you know, the climate cost. So we're going to go on a long drive somewhere or whatever. So there's, you know, the kids are really important in this conversation.
I also think it's really important, the positivity message for kids, because it is really, really heavy for them that who will be inheriting this. And they don't have the same carefree choices because we did and our parents did. And I think in those times when you are feeling that swirl of negativity of these things are bigger than me and they're bigger than all of us and it's too late and try to, gaining a sense of control by doing something and by doing something in your everyday life and in your sphere of influence is really important, and to teach kids that you are powerful and you can affect this change and you can help affect this change, I think is a really great
message. I mean, I've noticed, you know, this is a very personal thing, but the Comedy Wildlife books, when I bring them home, the kids love them, they enjoy them, they're proud to show their friends. There's a bit of pride because all my dad's name is on the front of a book. But then the kids...
First time for everything.
Exactly. And it's very short-lived. But they take the books and they... This Christmas, we're giving books to all the kids in both their classes because it's, why not, give the kids a Christmas gift. It's not a kid's book, but it's a book that appeals to kids. It's easy. I mean, adults laugh with it and children laugh with it and the kids get it. And then it's at the top level. They start to see the animals and the engagement begins. And it's a lovely thing to see, and it's lovely to see the kids engaging with all aspects of it, and they have their favorite pictures, and so it starts with positive. It doesn't say, look, the end of the world next week, we're all going to die, it's all awful. Here's some stuff, let's be positive. And we had the awards night last night, and talking to the head of Born Free, Will Travers, and he said it's one of the few, which is quite depressing to hear, but it's one of the few positive things that we hear about at the moment is your awards night and your winner, because the book comes out, the pictures are out, they're all over the press, and everything else is political negativity, riots all over the world. We're in a fairly dark period of time, it seems. It's
the other dark ages.
The other. And it's nice to have something that we can just say, come on, let's celebrate some good stuff.
Say thank you to the animals.
Yeah.
Thanks for the laughs.
Thanks for the laughs. Sorry you're being
sorry,
murdered.
Thanks for the laughs. And on that note, thank you, Paul, and thank you, Tom. You guys have been great. And we will have the website up on the link to the website so people can get involved.
Brilliant.
And send you their funny admissions. And
excellent.
They can also get tips on how to be more involved every day.
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
Thanks so much for having us.
And for more fabulous actual men, go to www.radiogorgeous.com.